Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. This Utah county just put the brakes on new data centers. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has a one-of-a-kind system for tracking abusers. Does it work? And can low-flow toilets and smart sprinklers solve Utah's drought? Here's the problem with the state's recommendations. Later in the program, we'll be talking with religion reporter Tamara Kemsley and data columnist Andy Larson. We bring in here for the first segment to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you. So data centers are all the rage, and here's an interesting twist on this. A Utah county just put the brakes on new data centers. Which county are we talking about?
Yeah, so that's Iron County in southwest Utah.
So I think there are some centers. I don't know if they have any centers right now, but there are some centers being proposed, right?
Yeah, so there's two applications right now for data centers in Iron County. One of them has been considered complete, so the Planning Commission will vote on that on June 4th next week, but the other application is deemed incomplete, so that will be paused under this 180-day ban that the County Commission just passed for approving or reviewing new or incomplete applications for data centers.
So these data centers, these are not the hyperscale that is proposed for Box Elder, right? Did no kind of the scale of these two proposed?
Yeah, these are significantly smaller. So I believe that one is closer to, 40,000 acres. The two that are proposed currently in Iron County, the one that the Planning Commission will vote on June 4th is 640 acres. The other one that will be put on pause is proposed to be around 2,564 acres.
So the Iron County Commission is put a essentially six-month pause on consideration of any new data centers. That will affect the one. Why are they doing this? What are they saying?
Yeah, so basically what they said in the meeting earlier this week is that, their local land ordinances, policies are not necessarily up to date for these, relatively new projects that the county hasn't had to review, these sort of kind of new developments before. And so they are wanting to update their policies to make sure there's protections in place. Something they emphasized was like the rural quality of Iron County. The majority of the land in Iron County, particularly county land, is zoned in a way that could, these data centers could be built on that land. And so they're thinking about putting, an overlay zone that specifies where these can be built, just so to protect some of that rural character. Others have raised concerns about water, energy, effects on the environment, things like that. So basically this pause gives the county time to see if there's ways they can strengthen their policies to protect the, communities and county and things people care about. And I will say that the meetings I've been to, it does seem like, the Stratus Data Center up north has definitely, the outcry around that has reached southwest Utah. So I think people in the southern part of the state are seeing what's happening up north and are concerned about a similar thing happening down south. So this move may also be responding just to the general, concern among Utahns across the whole state right now.
One county commissioner, I think it was county commissioner, said he started receiving comments at 5 a.m. and is in the dozens, multiple dozens of people calling him.
Yeah, so it sounds like their phones, are just like kind of ringing off the hook with people calling. They're getting tons of emails every day, for the past few weeks. So it's clear people are calling a lot with concerns about this.
So these two planned data centers, one will go forward, the other be affected by this pause. It's not just the data center, it's a natural gas plant associated with the data center as well.
Yep, so both of these, in the documents they've submitted to get review for a conditional use permit from the county include mention of natural gas plant. The Red Butte data center, which is the one that will be affected by this pause, that one also includes potential solar. So this pause also effectively puts a ban on approving any new utility scale solar projects. So the county's also getting applications for very large solar projects as well. And so they've decided to also lump that in with this pause, since it's, what I gathered is it's another kind of large scale project that, will cover, potentially thousands of acres.
What does Iron County hope to accomplish during this 6-month pause? They mentioned zoning. What are they hoping to come up with?
Yeah, I mean, kind of touched on this earlier, but it's mainly just, trying to strengthen their policies, potentially create this overlay zone that would specify where such projects could be built so that basically the entire county doesn't become overrun with them, was what I gathered. Maybe some other specific policies that, could protect water, the environment, or other elements that people are concerned about. So basically, it sounds like they want to review other policies in the state or other places that are dealing with this. They want to just assess how they can, if there are changes they should make to their local land ordinances to protect the rural character, address these concerns, things like that.
You know, there was a nearly 4-hour open house for the Red Butte project. That's the one being paused, I think, a couple of weeks ago. What are residents saying? What are they generally concerned? Are there some in support? What's the tenor, do you think?
Yeah, so I attended this hearing for the Red Butte Data Center a few weeks ago. It was like an open house hosted by the company Brightknight, who's proposing this project. And it went on for almost 4 hours. And I would say overwhelmingly that the people who at least spoke up, who were present there, were opposed to it. I heard, at least one that was in support, a few that just had questions, but most of the comments during that were opposed or at least concerned about it. This area, has been, Iron County has been overdrawing its groundwater supplies. And so there's currently multiple groundwater management plans in place, where the Division of Water Rights is, regulating water rights there. Water rights are being cut back. And so it's an area that is already pretty water stressed. So that was a big concern I heard. And, people were pretty educated about the water situation in their community, more so than the company proponent. There was some interesting tense moments where he didn't know the specific water policies, and people were sort of educating him in the moment. So I think that is a big concern that these companies are coming in without fully understanding the water situation in Iron County.
Yeah, one resident, interesting comment, said water rights are not water. You might have a right, but there might not be water to.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that really is the case in Iron County since, over the next few decades, the Division of Water Rights will be essentially regulating and reducing the water rights in the county. So just because you have a water right does not mean that you will be getting water in the future in Iron County.
So these data centers, I think, they're proposing to use water basically from aquifers there.
Yeah, so with the Red Butte data center, they're hoping to secure water rights. So basically, it sounds like their plan would be to buy water rights from, farmers, landowners that they would ultimately also be acquiring land from to build this data center. So their plan is to acquire water rights that are, currently being used to water alfalfa and things like that. And they argue that they'll end up using less water than is currently being used by those farmers. The other project, the Antelope Data Center, that will be voted on next week for the conditional use permit, that one would like to kind of tap into the county's water district supply, so receive water directly through the water district. So, and if that doesn't work, they've said they'll acquire other water rights. So that's the two approaches they're each taking.
Some other concerns from residents that you list here, potential increase in taxes, right? Air pollution.
Yeah, so in general, it seems like residents just want to understand more, what the tax structure would be. Would these projects be getting tax incentives? Or there's, one concern that was brought up at the meeting earlier this week was some specifically, the company on the Red Butte Data Center, they sort of pitched all these community benefits that they could bring in, new infrastructure, scholarships, things like that. And a resident was concerned if, say, this company builds like, a new, I don't know, it's all very hypothetical, but say like a community rec center or something like that, like what's the sustainability ability to ultimately fall on taxpayers down the line kind of thing. So those were some concerns that have been brought up. I mean, on the flip side, they've also talked about, the property taxes that could be coming into the county from these centers. So I think the tax piece, there's still some questions there about will it benefit or hurt, residents. Some of the other concerns, yeah, energy, residents talked about outages they've already experienced from time to time. And so there's concern about, putting, more pressure on the grid. There's concern about heat. I think we've heard a lot about that with, the Stratus data center, that it could create this big, heat island effect. And so there's, I think some of people are hearing these concerns with the Stratus data center and, concerned about how much it will apply to these smaller projects as well in Iron County.
You note that the commissioners, Iron County commissioners, are saying that that there's a need for data centers in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of this. I think this data center debate, we're seeing it. This isn't just a Utah story, right? We're seeing this happen everywhere across the nation, this question about the need for them. And, the commissioners and even the few people I've heard speak out in support of this talk about, we use the cloud, we use all this computing technology that relies on data centers, that the growth in artificial intelligence. And some people have talked about, well, I've been using the internet for 30 years and we haven't needed the scale of data centers. So I think it is just tying into this larger debate we're having across the country and maybe across the world about what is the need for data centers, what's the future of this technology. And yeah, I've heard politicians, repeatedly acknowledge that we all use, different things that depend on these data centers, and trying to kind of bring that into the conversation as well. And then there's also kind of this pushback on, well, how much do we actually need? So it's an interesting discussion for sure.
Is there provision for comments during these 6 months? Or is the commission or the planning commission taking comments? Maybe it's not needed if the commissioners' phones are continuing to blow up, but.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know. I have not heard if there will be like specific hearings on this as they are assessing this over the 6 month pause. You know, during county and planning commission meetings, there are times for public comments. So I'm sure we will continue to see people take whatever opportunity they can to speak up on this. I saw there's, you know, a protest this weekend in Iron County around these data centers. So it seems like whether people are calling in, protesting, or finding a way in these public meetings, that people intend to continue to share their thoughts on this.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson telling us about this. Brooke, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
And you're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following a brief break, I'm going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Here is the headline we're talking about. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has a one-of-a-kind system for tracking abusers. Does it work? Later in the program, data columnist Andy Larson. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring into this segment religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Tamara, thank you so much.
Yeah, great to be here.
Interesting story. Here's the headline. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has a one-of-a-kind system for tracking abusers. Does it work? This is the Tribune investigation. So tell me what, I guess, first of all, how does the Latter-day Saints system compare to, you know, other Protestant churches, other churches?
So the primary difference is that there is the centralized governing body, which allows the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to maintain a database of all of the members around the world. Some other faiths, Catholics, for instance, will keep records on clergy, priests. But for Latter-day Saints, even if you were baptized at 8 and never returned again, they have a record of you. That doesn't mean that they count you as part of their adherent when they announce, you know, the number by which the church has grown. For example, if someone resigns, if someone is kicked out of the rolls, they're not counted in that number. But even in those cases, the church maintains a record of that person. And that record includes name, birth date, children that they may or may not have, important callings or volunteer assignments that they've had. And it also includes something called an annotation. And that annotation is what this story was really about, was how do those work?
First of all, what is the official church saying about this? I guess they have some statements in the handbook, and I guess church spokesman has talked about this.
Yeah, so the annotation is, according to the church spokesperson and different websites or pages on the church's website and in its handbook, it's really key. It's, quote, vital to help local leaders protect the congregations, because an annotation is given to someone who confesses to abuse, or there's a whole list. Most of them are crimes, for example, murder, incest, plural marriage. Those all get in, you'll get an annotation. Also, if you transition away from your assigned sex at birth, abuse, fraud, financial abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, all of those. If you confess, or if you're found guilty of in court, either convicted or found liable, that will require, per policy, the local leadership to hold a disciplinary council. And that disciplinary council can result in formal membership restriction, that meaning you can't hold a volunteer assignment, you can't give prayer, you can't give a sermon at church, or a full excommunication, now known as membership withdrawal. In either case, the record of that individual receives an annotation. And I interviewed 5 different former bishops, some of them also either former stake presidents or have served or are serving in stake presidencies. And what they described was this literal red flag that will then appear in the church's software system known as, Leadership and Clerk Resources is the software that bishops and clerks and then stake presidents who are regional leaders over clusters of congregations, all the way up to the church president, have access to and can view these annotations. However, those annotations do not come with much or really any detail. So say I am a bishop and I sign in and I'm a brand new bishop and I have a couple of members with this red flag on their record. I am going to have to either reach out to headquarters itself or to the previous bishop to get details on why that annotation is there.
How are these annotations used in practice by leaders? I guess to not assign people to certain assignments, or what? How is this used?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is one. Is, for example, if a record is annotated, the software will not allow the person to receive a calling, for example, with youth. It's very possible, though, that leaders, local leaders, don't even think to go into the software to make those assignments, right? They might just be done verbally and then inputted later, at which point then they would receive, then they would hit this sort of guardrail that the software has built in. There's also the possibility of a bishop simply ignoring those kind of restrictions or not inquiring about an annotation that he doesn't have information about. I also spoke to leaders who they did inquire, but the information they got was very minimal. For example, one bishop in Utah, former bishop in Utah, said he had a member who moved in who had an annotation. And he called Salt Lake, got a report, and it said that this member had shown predatory behavior towards adult women. He knew the time frame, but he didn't know the degree or nature of those offenses. How serious were they? Did they take place on church property? Or were these women from church? How many women were involved? All of that information, he just had none of it.
So I guess a variety of opinions, people you talk to, but in general, were they saying, is this effective? What would they like to see instituted in addition?
Yeah, that's the crux of it, right? Does it work? And the answer is sometimes. And that is according to both the people I worked with, the bishops and the people who have worked directly with the system, but also talking to people who work and study abuse prevention and abuse reporting. And even I stumbled on this expert, his name is Robert Peters, who's with an organization called GRACE, and their entire purpose is to help pastors respond to and prevent abuse in their congregations. And the thing that he stressed over and over is that it is so important for everyone in the congregation to have access to those kind of details that I just listed, in the case of a known abuser, for example, who, what kind of victims does the abuser seek out, in what context, what is their history, what kind of is the seriousness of their past history, all of which is really kept in the Latter-day Saint context to bishops and maybe their ward clerks and then higher ups. But on the congregational level, it's really just bishops. Now, bishops can inform others. They can tell the leader the young women's program, right, which is teenage girls, or the primary president, who is always a woman and is in charge of the children's program. And he can tell them that so-and-so, his record is a flag on it. But they do not have independent access to that information.
So I guess what I'm hearing is, some of these folks are saying it's a strength that Latter-day Saint member, that their membership follows them wherever they go in the world, and that annotation would follow them as well. So it's less likely to be dropped between the cracks. But I guess an ask that they're asking the church is make this more widely known among congregations.
Yeah, they did. They stressed that the fact that there is a database at all is helpful. But tracking abusers and actually preventing abuse are two different things. And if you're actually going to prevent further abuse by known individuals, known abusers, there needs to be broad awareness, because especially in the case of abusive minors, these individuals have a pattern. They're usually seeking out a new opportunity. That's according to this Robert Peters, who was a former prosecutor in West Virginia before he went and started developing these trainings for other prosecutors, and then this organization Zero Abuse Project, and now Grace. And the other thing that Christine Bartholomew, who is a legal scholar, who has looked a lot at laws regarding clergy and clergy penitent privilege, is that there is no legal reason for a pastor or other clergy member to not inform congregants. The clergy penitent privilege, which is often cited by faith institutions as a reason for not divulging information about predatory or threatening behavior that has been obtained by clergy, either in an official confessionary setting or outside of one, is that this law protects that kind of exchange of information. And she's saying, no, it doesn't, except for when you're talking about what an individual can present in court. It's an evidentiary ruling. It does not relate to the conversations that a pastor or other clergy member may have with their congregants.
One of the former leaders you talked to, former bishop, he notes, or at least implies, reminds us that the leadership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a lay ministry. He'd like to see standardized training in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a former bishop, and I believe he was also a stake president. I talked to a lot of people, and that was the thing he kept coming back to, is, you know, we're just all kind of, we've got this handbook that the church gives us, but these situations are so individualized and the stakes are so high. And one bishop might be more alarmed by something than another bishop. And there just needs to be some way for there to be a standardized operation if we're really going to enforce best practices church-wide.
Anything else you'd like to say about this story?
Just that it is ongoing. We are still trying to understand all of the ways that this is being practiced And in all kinds of different church settings all around the world, Latter-day Saint church settings. So if you have experience with this, there is on the story on our website, you'll find it in the religion section, a form that anyone can fill out to share their experience with it with us. And so if you have firsthand knowledge, either as a former bishop or state president or as someone who is impacted by this process, please reach out.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And following a brief break, we will check in with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist. He had an interesting column this week. Here's the headline: Can low-flow toilets and smart sprinklers solve Utah's drought? Here's the problem with the state's recommendations. Talk with Andy Larson on Behind the Headlines following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and we bring in next Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson. Andy, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks again for having me, Tom.
Very interesting column this week. Here is the headline: Can low-flow toilets and smart sprinklers solve Utah's drought? Here's the problem with the state's recommendations. So you go in detail through the recommendations, such as they are. Some of them are a little vague. But you note that Governor Cox declared a state of emergency. Outline for us, as you do in the story, just how dire the situation is.
Yeah, and this is something that Spencer Cox did put in the executive order about the drought. But, you know, listed that snowpack here in Utah peaked about 3 weeks early, was about 53% of normal this winter, and which means that water supply forecasts around the state range between 20% of normal to 55% of normal. And so, you know, I think we've known this has been coming for a few months now as the winter was so rough, but it is clear that this is going to be an exceptionally difficult year with regards to the drought and just Utah's water supply in general.
No, it didn't seem like anything mandatory in Governor Cox's, proclamation. A lot of encouragement, I suppose. So you go through each of these encouragements, I guess, and try to parse out how much we could save.
Yeah, and so that's kind of what I thought about doing when I saw the executive order, is trying to understand, okay, you know, yeah, these aren't necessarily compulsory actions that the governor is asking people or water companies or even irrigators to take. It's really about kind of recommendations at this step of the process. And so I wanted to know two things. One, how effective would these recommendations be, if and realistically, how much water can we expect them to save? And two, you know, what is the difference between having voluntary recommendations here and kind of mandatory restrictions like we've seen in other states? And so, yeah, I went through Cox has a list of five different encouragements for residents here, Utahns here in the state, to save some water, and was curious how much those would save, along with a couple other additions here in terms of what cities and water districts can do in order to save water. And really what I was curious about is, yeah, how much water we can save doing each. So looked at, for example, the impact of purchasing a smart timer controller. That's about 300 acre feet that you might be able to save over the course of a year statewide in terms of water if a realistic number of people purchase smart timer controllers for their sprinkler systems. Low flow toilets, we know about 600 Utahns got toilet rebates in 2023. That saves about 15 acre feet of water. And ultimately kind of went through the list of ideas Cox had in the executive order and found that the total amount of water saved there was smaller than that, you know, which is really required to do something about the drought in our state.
Let's go through a few more of these. It's interesting how you sort of reason through this. Of course, data, right? You're a data columnist. Residents should reduce indoor water use by fixing leaks. How did you get to your conclusion on this one?
Yeah, and this is kind of the back of the napkin math that I did, you know, kind of across all of these different categories. But the Water Research Foundation on this one found that about 13% of indoor water usage was wasted due to leakage of some sort, whether that be a toilet leak, shower leak, sinks, whatever it may be. And we know that Utah has about 1.2 million households overall. We know about how much indoor water use there is. And so you can just do the math kind of straight across and say, hey, if we fix every leak in Utah, every indoor leak in Utah, it would save about 23,600 acre feet of water per year. But we also know that if we're doing recommendations, and we know that, you know, leaks are hard to find, and certainly not every Utahn is checking what the governor is saying and so on and so forth, they may not be even be aware of these leaks. We can expect about a 1% uptake in terms of these recommendations. So I estimated about 230 acre feet of water might be saved by this recommendation. Well, kind of acknowledging, like, yes, if every leak were saved, we would get about 23,000.
An acre foot, what is that?
Yeah, it's I should look up the number of gallons, but it is the amount of feet, or I guess it's the amount of acreage that would be covered by 1 foot of water. Mm. And so it's a unit of water measurement that's used a lot in kind of these contexts where we're talking about how much water is needed to fill the Great Salt Lake, or how much water is diverted in the state of Utah on a yearly basis, rather than the number of gallons, which is obviously, you know, maybe more familiar to you and I, but just not all that useful on this kind of scale. Acre feet really kind of underlines the amount of water that we're using here. And it's kind of used in kind of these irrigation and water usage tabulations far more frequently than gallons are.
Now, you mentioned smart timers and low flow toilets, and you note that in both those cases, for example, the smart timer controller, the state issued rebates, but it didn't amount to a whole lot.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the things we found is, you know, certainly these rebates lead to more action than there may be otherwise in terms of saving water. But you look at, for example, with smart timer controllers in 2023, they issued about 3,000 rebates for those controllers. Mentioned earlier, it's about 600 rebates for the low flow toilets. And that's about, you know, 0.5% of eligible sprinkler systems and an even smaller number in terms of toilet replacements. And so, you know, I think that kind of gives us a reasonable estimation on to what extent kind of these voluntary rebate programs can make an impact. And then I'll also say, in this executive order, there are no new rebate programs. There are no new kind of incentives to push residents or Utahns statewide to be doing things. Cox has left that kind of up to individual water districts and cities to implement those on their own.
Now, residents should consider converting unnecessary lawn areas to water-wise landscapes. You went to Central Utah Water Conservancy District, which has, I guess, done some work on this to get your estimate.
Yeah, and they've done a lot of research and some good research on kind of how much non-functional turf, quote unquote, is across their region, and we can kind of extrapolate to Utah generally. And the Central Utah Water Conservancy District contains all or parts of Southern Utah counties, including the major metropolitan areas here in Salt Lake and Utah counties. And they found that there were roughly 10,500 acres of non-functional turf. And that's defined as turf when people aren't using it. So if you're, you know, if no one ever walks across this part of turf, it's probably non-functional. So we're talking like roadway medians, we're talking park strips, we're talking commercial frontages, you know, those kind of things that you probably could replace with kind of more water-wise landscaping without losing a whole lot of functionality. And if you replaced all of that turf, all 10,500 acres, you would save a lot of water, 80,000 acre feet of water. But obviously replacing all of it, you know, statewide is really unlikely. You know, the state's incentive program, there is an incentive program to replace lawn and convert that. That ended up being about 68 acres saved out of that 10,500 in the Central Utah Water Conservancy District. That saved about 300 acre feet of water. Southern Nevada has a similar program that was a little bit more successful. They were able to convert about 1,000 acre feet and save about 1,000 acre feet of water. But it's, you know, so I'm kind of being optimistic and hoping more residents will kind of take up these conservational landscape approaches. But, you know, again, without a mandatory program, and it's hard to get people to do this necessarily in a widespread sort of way.
Residents should fix irrigation leaks and inefficiencies. That makes sense. How do we know how many broken pipes and leaks we have out there?
Again, we're guessing, but we're using the best information we have. So you start with the number of homes you have here in Utah, right? So you've got about 900,000 detached homes in Utah. We estimate that there are roughly 600,000 residential sprinkler systems in the state, and, you know, kind of underground automated sprinkler systems. That's based on a survey from 2014, which indicated about that percentage. And then, you know, we use a University of Florida audit of 3,000 homes down there that found 28% had broken or leaky pipes in some way. Guessing roughly 600 million gallons of water could be saved by fixing those systems, or about 1,840 acre feet. Again, we're using back of the napkin kind of math here, but kind of the idea is to show the order of magnitudes of difference between the conservational approaches recommended in the document and the amount of water we really need to save this summer in order to make changes.
Let's do a couple more of these and then get to your bottom line. So state agencies shall follow existing conservation rules from a 2023 executive order and the Division of Water Resources Weekly Watering Guide. I guess in that time period, there was some progress made.
Certainly, and this is maybe the one where, you know, this is not just a recommendation. This is a mandatory effect of the executive order, where the agencies have to operate by the watering guide, you know, and under Cox's control. This is something that they have to do. Under a bill passed, I believe in 2022, they have to reduce their usage by 25%, I should say, by the year 2026. The last update on this was in 2023 when they said they were about 20% of the way there. And that's, I actually talked to the state facility water tracker folks, and they haven't compiled information since 2024, but they should have information for 2026 coming up by the end of June. We know that they've already saved roughly 855 acre-feet of water at state facilities, which is great. They need about 200 more acre-feet in order to reach the statutory goal there. But it may even be greater than that, and they may end up saving, you know, 300, 500 acre feet of water. I chose to be optimistic and say, hey, they could save 500 acre feet. But as you can imagine, you know, state facilities, while they, you know, certainly there are a lot of them, are not a high overall percentage of our state's land.
Now, you treat a couple of these which are even more vague, and so you just come up with some estimates. One is water suppliers and irrigation companies should consider encouraging efficient landscape watering, and residents are encouraged to reduce outdoor water use and waste. So as a data columnist, what do you do with that thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just look at similar efforts in other states and other locations and see how those worked and kind of different approaches may have worked, right? So I looked at a campaign that sent water use mailers to neighbors and said, compared how their water use compared to their neighbors, and found that kind of some social pressure resulted in water consumption falling about 5%. Another study in California looked at kind of individualized recommendations based on people's water bills, how they could conserve water, and saw realized savings of about 3%. So, you know, I said, hey, you know, obviously implementation is going to vary from district to district and water supplier to water supplier and irrigation company to irrigation company. But let's be optimistic and assume a 4% overall decrease there. That would save 20,000 acre feet of water. You know, that would be a significant savings, given that landscape watering represents about 500,000 acre feet overall. But again, we just don't really know what kind of plans or kind of what encouraging means in this landscape, because, you know, different districts are going to be doing different things.
One last one: developing a local drought response plan or implementing water restriction plans. What do you estimate here?
Yeah, again, just it's so hard to know what these companies may be doing. The one note I had on this is just a study from the Alliance for Water Efficiency. They're a group that does what they sound like. But from 2020, they looked at water restriction plans in California, Arizona, Nevada, and Texas found that measures that relied upon voluntary conservation did not generate statistically significant savings. Meanwhile, the mandatory restriction, so not voluntary but mandatory, did result in reduced annual demand by between 18 and 30%. I looked at another meta study of actually 23 different studies from the year 1978 all the way to 2022, found an average reduction of 12.3% when you're doing these kind of mandatory restrictions. So again, getting an idea of how much water we can realistically save through these kind of residential or drought response plans when there is kind of more mandatory rather than voluntary restrictions on them.
So if you add up everything that we just talked about and your estimates of these non-mandatory suggestions, what do you get?
Yeah, I estimate about 25,000 acre feet. And I, you know, can't estimate this enough. This is hedged. This is back of napkin math. This is doing our best to estimate what each of these might be worth. But I think that, you know, order of magnitude is about right. About 25,000 acre feet we might realistically save if there was kind of very optimistic uptake of these recommendations.
Now, you compare that, depressingly here, to what researchers say we need to put into the Great Salt Lake every year for the next 20 years. What is that figure?
Yeah, the Great Salt Lake Strike Team reported that in order to get the Great Salt Lake back up to healthy levels, I believe it's 4,192 feet of you know, kind of the elevation mark of the water, that it would take 540,000 acre feet. So about 20 times what we might save in the course of these recommendations. And that's 540,000 acre feet per year over the course of 20 years in order to get the lake back to a healthy level. Then also compared it, frankly, to what the Stratos data center project developers, they originally mentioned a estimate of about 13,000 acre feet just for that project alone. So it's tough, right? Like it's these recommendations just, you know, they may make a dent in our overall water needs and especially with regards to the Great Salt Lake. But if you look at what actually is going to be making a difference, it's hard to say that these voluntary recommendations will change the course of the Great Salt Lake in the way that I think we probably need as a state. And instead, we kind of have to look at maybe the larger water users and maybe some more mandatory restrictions across the board that might make the difference.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune data columnist Andy Larson telling us about this. He took the governor's emergency proclamation step by step and came up with an estimate. Bottom line, he's saying we just probably need mandatory is what we need.
You know, you just look at around what other states around Utah are doing, and especially, you know, Nevada, Arizona, California, Texas, they have significantly reduced their water usage in bigger, you know, percentages than Utah has. And they've done it through some really kind of making hard decisions and forcing their residents to use and their, you know, agriculture sector as well, to use water differently. And I think, you know, it's probably time for us to take that approach here in Utah, given the drought we're facing.
Andy Larson, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Our thanks to Andy Larson, Tamara Kemsley, and Brooke Larson, who have joined us on the program today. And thank you for joining us. Hope you'll be with me again next time.